Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
After we pass this bill, being a woman will no longer be a pre-existing medical condition.
Then again, Speaker Pelosi, maybe this health care bill is not the best thing in the world for women. The Democratic Party spent the weekend on bended knee to its anti-abortion rights wing to convince them they really were erecting sufficient barriers to insurance coverage that includes abortion. And being a woman in some respects may still be considered a pre-existing condition. President Obama is going to sign the health care law, a bill into law, in just a few minutes, and we will go live to the ceremony if we can. But with us first are Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, and Trudy Lieberman, who's been blogging the health reform process for the Columbia Journalism Review and who teaches at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Trudy Lieberman, welcome back. Terry O'Neill, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Thanks, Brian.
Trudy, first explain the abortion restrictions as you understand them, because a lot of people don't understand them.
Well, the Hyde Amendment, as I understand it, still stands, and that's what the president's executive order was about, that there still will be no federal funding of abortions. And the issue that I've been following was how the coverage of abortion is going to play out in the exchanges. And those exchanges, just to recap for your listeners, are the giant shopping services that the states will be setting up beginning in 2014. And so people who will be requiring subsidies, which is most of the uninsured or vast numbers of them, will go to these exchanges to buy their coverage. So then the problem comes in about women who want to buy coverage for abortion. And this has been the sticking point for quite a while. And the way that this eventually was resolved, which is the way it was pretty much resolved in November, was that there would be a segregation of the coverage that a woman could buy a policy, but there had to be another policy offered that did not have abortion coverage in it, and that this is a logistical nightmare. It appears to be one for the insurance companies. The Wall Street Journal reported today that these stricter rules in the exchange may mean fewer insurers will offer coverage, and the question can be raised, is that what Mr. Stupak and others had in mind all along?
So, Terry O'Neill, I know the National Organization for Women was furiously working against this provision over the weekend. Do you think it's bad enough that the president should not sign the law?
If I were the president, I would not sign the law. I think that on balance, the law is unfortunately not good for women. That's the policy issue. Now, I understand politics. I do get that there are too many anti-choice votes in the United States House of Representatives. I do get that as a political matter, organizations like mine and our allied organizations are we to get our agenda moved forward. We're much better off with a strong president, and then the president would not have been strong if he didn't get health care passed. I get that, but my job is to tell the truth about what's in the bill, and what's in the bill is there's good things for women and there's a lot of bad things for women. And on balance, we made the call that this is a bill that should not have been passed.
You know that the bill almost went down because the Senate version, which is becoming law, was seen as too lenient on abortion coverage by opponents compared to the House version, which got left behind. I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal today, which has an op-ed on the end of the so-called pro-life Democrats, because the Stupak group compromised into this loophole of a block or of a bill. So if the so-called right-to-life movement is so furious with the bill, how can now be too?
Well, the right to life will not be satisfied until not only abortion but also birth control is completely unavailable to every single woman in this country. And since the bill doesn't achieve that, I guess they're very dissatisfied. The bill that passed, the Senate bill that passed, the George Washington University's School of Public Health studied both the Stupak-Pitts language, which did not make its way, by the way, into this bill. We did fight that, and we won. We successfully got it out. But it, they they also studied the Reed-Nelson language, which is in the bill, which we also fought against. And the School of Public Health concluded that under the Reed-Nelson language, within a few years, now it may take as many as 8 years or so, but within some years, the insurance companies will simply decide not to offer any coverage to any woman for abortion, period. Okay.
We are about 4 minutes away from the scheduled time of the signing of the bill. We don't know how late this is actually going to run. These things do sometimes run late. We're going to open up our phones for as much time as we have for women to say what you like or don't like about the health care bill as it pertains to women in particular. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, and Trudy Lieberman, who's been blogging the health reform process for the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy Lieberman, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi's clip from her speech on the floor just before it passed on Sunday night, we played that clip that says no longer will women be being a woman be considered a pre-existing condition. Is that technically true?
Technically. I want to, in the minute or two we may have left, I want to speak to two issues that I think are really going to hurt women, and particularly older women. I know Terry's concern is for younger women of childbearing years, but I'm concerned also about older women, and that's the age rating provision that's in the bill. Technically, insurance companies will no longer be able to deny people if they have a health condition, and this begins in 2014. What that means is the insurance companies have to find some other way to do their underwriting and find out who's a good risk and who's a bad risk. And the Congress is allowing them to charge older people more. In fact, they can charge older people three times more than a younger person for the same coverage in the same area. And what that means is that a lot of older women, and this has surfaced as a problem in Massachusetts, that the older women's organizations were very upset about this summer. And in Massachusetts, it's only a 2-for-1 ratio, not 3-to-1. So what's going to happen is these women displaced from the workforce, and this will apply to men too, but often women, as we know, have other workforce problems. They're not in the workforce as much, they don't earn as much, and so forth. And so those women, say at age 55 or 58 or 60, too young for Medicare, are going to be paying a whole lot of money if they go to the exchanges to buy these policies and get the subsidies. They will be required to have a policy, and to get money to help them pay for it, they'll have to go to the exchange and get socked with a higher premium. So, you know, you have to sort of look at what the hidden details are here. And there's another way I think that women might not be helped by this, and that's the women who are on Social Security disability. And there are lots of women, and particularly of all ages, but particularly older women who've had a Social Security work history. And they are sick enough or disabled enough that they qualify for Social Security disability, and that's a very hard hurdle to overcome. And this bill, at the moment, this issue just was not addressed in the bill, despite some advocacy around it. It just didn't have any traction. So those people will still have to wait 2 years before they're eligible for Medicare once they get on Social Security. And I can tell you, Brian, I have interviewed lots of older women over my career, and this is really a difficult problem for them that is not being solved right now. Sure, they can go to the exchanges in 4 years, but right now they don't have many options.
Terry O'Neill, any other woman-related aspects of this bill besides the abortion provisions we were talking about that
Absolutely.
You would point out, good or bad?
Absolutely, and Trudy's absolutely right. We did object to the age rating, and by the way, one of the reasons it hits middle-aged women so hard is because of a lifetime of wage discrimination. Mm-hmm. So women have less income to pay these triple premiums, and they also have less savings, less wealth, because they've been discriminated against in wages for their entire career. The other thing that we're really concerned about is we've repeatedly been told that this bill will take out gender rating, which is the practice where insurance companies charge up to 50% more for women just because they're women. That, in fact, has not gone away under this bill. It is permitted in the exchanges to employers who buy into a plan in the exchange if the employer has 100 or more employees. Now, down the road, and I believe it's something like in 2017, large employers are going to be permitted to migrate into the exchanges if they want to. Once that happens, you've got virtually the entire population, at least of people getting their insurance through their employers. Gender rating will be right back in there, so women will be paying 50% more. You know, the another thing that now has been very upset about is we have long supported a single-payer health care system, Medicare for all, and this bill makes it harder than the House bill did to eventually make our way towards single payer. Makes it, the states are not going to have an easy time to experiment with single payer systems. The public option, as we all know, was killed, and so that's another issue, another reason why we believe, on balance, the bill really was not a good bill.
Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. Trudy Lieberman, contributor on health issues for the Columbia Journalism Review. I think the president's going to walk out onto the stage at the White House any second. How will you work in whatever time we have left, Terry O'Neill, to address the shortcomings that you see in this bill in later legislation?
So two things. We are mounting a national action campaign to repeal the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment is what is the springboard for the anti-abortion measures in the bill that we see now. So we want to repeal the Hyde Amendment. That's number one. Number two, we are strongly supporting Connie Saltonstall for Congress. She is running against Bart Stupak in the Democratic primary. Anyone who's interested should go to www.nowpac.org. You'll see information about her. We're supporting Lois Herr for Congress. She will be challenging Joe Pitts, the Republican who was the co-author of Stupak Pitts.
And Trudy Lieberman, how possible do you think it is politically to repeal the Hyde Amendment, named after former Congressman Henry Hyde, which prevents federal funding for abortions?
I think it might be difficult. There's a lot of people on the other side who are just as opposed to it as Terry's group is. For it, as Terry's group is against it. I think there will be lots of opportunities for different groups to come in and weigh in and try to repeal different parts of this bill that aren't to their liking. And it's going to boil down to politics in the midterm elections and beyond. I think that we are not finished with health care reform.
Let's take a shot at a caller here. I really don't know how much time we have left. People have already taken their seats in the White House, so not much. But Vicki in the Bronx, we'll give you a shot here. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead.
I wanted to comment that I was really surprised about the now position that's voiced by your guest. I live in the Bronx. I myself am an educator. I have often been in unions, as I currently am, so I've always had health insurance. But I have many family members, including a number of women, single moms, supporting kids, who often don't have health insurance and who are either lower middle class, working class, or sometimes working poor.
So for you, even with the shortcomings, the balance is a plus.
Absolutely. And I care about abortion rights, but when I look at my family members, if that kind of issue comes up, it's a short-term issue.
Vicki, I have to leave it there to get any chance at a response. Terry O'Neill, go ahead.
Sophie's choice is not okay. We cannot be a society that says, do you choose to provide services to the woman with cancer, or do you choose to provide services with the woman who has a heart condition and needs an abortion? That is not the society we can afford to have. The reason that we fought so hard on this is precisely because, you know, we don't accept that as our choice. We must provide full services to every single woman. Abortion care is basic health care. It should not be singled out and stigmatized and taken away.
Tahila in Flatbush, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tahila.
Yes, I agree. There are many cases where women need abortions because it's medically necessary, as in the case of preeclampsia. Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous to take this right away, and it's unconstitutional. It basically is overturning Roe v. Wade through the legislator and the president, and it's also obliterating the separation between church and state. And it's very, very dangerous.
Would you have wanted your Congress member to vote no on the whole bill?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Julieta in Mount Kisco. You're on WNYC. Hello, Julieta.
Hey, Ryan. I just wanted to say that while all this is going on, deciding to repeal and working toward getting the Hyde Amendment off the table, I really feel that early abortion methods should be available to all women over-the-counter, it is possible to get methotrexate abortions and not involve doctors and injections. I mean, methotrexate injections, as well as, I know Plan B is a contraceptive method, but if we had greater access to this and more education about it in the meantime, while we are waiting for the dust to settle, I think this would be really important.
Julieta, thank you. Trudy Lieberman, on the gender rating for middle-aged women, why did they stick to this?
Why did they stick to it? Because the insurance companies probably wanted it. The insurance companies made a deal very early on. They said, okay, we'll get rid of the most egregious thing, which is the failure to give coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. But we have to remember that this is a private insurance system. We have private insurance companies. We're going to give them a whole lot of new business. And if they take people who have serious health problems and end up costing them a lot of money, and people with serious health problems do, then they don't make very much money. So what they have to do is find ways that they can kind of do their underwriting through the back door. And the continuation of gender rating in the employer market, and God knows what will happen to it when these plans go into the exchange down the road, is another one of those backdoor methods. And I think that what people need to realize is that this is what's going to happen. And there are a lot of things hidden in this bill, and it's going to take a long time before they get all sorted out. But the insurance companies are going to find a way to do underwriting.
Joan?
Because they can't stay in business if they don't.
Joan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'd like to point out another aspect of Social Security disability and Medicare law that discriminates against women that rarely gets mentioned, and that is that when you have to qualify for disability, you must have a certain number of work credits based on your age, and of course you have to be determined to be disabled. But there's another requirement that is very hard for women to get through, and that is that you must have 20 credits in the previous 10 years. In other words, if you took time out of your work life to raise children or take care of an elderly parent, you could be denied disability even though you have enough credits and you're disabled. Are you aware of that aspect of the law?
Terry O'Neill, do you know that?
Yes, we do, and we objected to it. Absolutely. There's two wonderful organizations, the Older Women's League and the Institute for Women's Policy Research, that have done an enormous amount of work on this. It's a little known but absolutely egregious fact. One of the things we're trying to do, it's not about health care, but about trying to get women who drop out of the workforce to care for kids or elderly, to give them the credits. In other words, so that they would be deemed to have stayed in the workforce. Mm-hmm. But that we haven't been able to do it yet. We're working on it.
But wouldn't it be just better to remove that restriction? In fact, there is one exception to that rule, which is blind people. So it's a discrimination against women, and it's a discrimination against some disabilities in favor of other disabilities. It makes no sense at all. If you're blind, it doesn't matter when you do the work. If you have any other disability, it does matter.
Right. I know. It's ridiculous.
It's crazy. It makes no sense.
Thank you for your call, Joan. Trudy Lieberman, you've been covering not only the health care debate itself, but the coverage of the health care debate for the Columbia Journalism Review all this time. We've been through all this for the past year, not to mention, you know, our whole lifetimes where this issue comes and goes. But one of the big disputes now is whether the public has a reasonable sense of what's really in this bill through the media, or whether it's been so distorted by the political back and forth. Do you have any opinion about that?
Yes, I have a lot of opinions about that since I have written about it, including the latest issue of the Columbia Journalism Review. There's a print piece in the Marx issue that deals with this issue. The problem is this. The media, the politicians, Obama, some of the advocacy groups, the real big supporters of this bill and people who put a lot of skin in the game here weren't really too keen on explaining every little jot and tiddling item in the bill, because they were afraid that if people really understood all the ramifications of this, this might get in the way of actually passing it. So what's amusing to me right now is to see that the media is now coming out with all these consumer-type stories, news you can use and what's in it for you. And we've argued all along on CJR.org and given all kinds of story ideas and hints to the media to start covering this right now and tell people what's in it for them, because they are confused. They have never really understood it. We know from the poll numbers they don't really support it, but how much of that is because they don't know about it? And so what we have here is an electorate that is kind of uninformed about this. And what I'm going to be doing is kind of looking at the press coverage of these sort of how-to stories and see whether they are informative or they're not informative. And one of the things we've been doing on CJR.org is a series called The Devil in the Details. And there's about 7 devil pieces up there over the last several months, and we're going to continue that series and go into some of these little items in the bill, like the gender rating, for example, and explain to people what really is happening here and what you can expect. It might be good for you and it might not be good for you, but people have a right to know, and that's the job of the media.
I want to thank Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, for coming on with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And Trudy Lieberman, who's been blogging the health reform process for the Columbia Journalism Review. We may get yet another word from you after a break, so stick around if you can, but if not, thanks a lot.
Okay, I can stay for a few more minutes.
And we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back, and we are told any second, any minute, the President of the United States is going to have remarks as he signs the historic health care measure. We will cover it live. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we await the signing ceremony for the health reform legislation. Live from the White House, I see Senator Harry Reid coming into the room now, Congressman Henry Waxman, who's been fighting for a bill like this for 20, 25 years. I see Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So we are just seconds away, probably, from President Obama signing this bill. Trudy Lieberman from the Columbia Journalism Review has been covering this over the past year and for a long, long time. Is this the way you thought health care reform would look?
Well, I think it was pretty clear during the election campaign that this is how it was going to look. And again, I wrote a print piece for the magazine talking about Groundhog Day for health care. And the elements of this bill have been in place for decades. We really have never embraced a single-payer option, even though there was a bit of talk and concern about that this year, mostly from very vocal single-payer advocates who felt quite marginalized by the process. But when you look at what we seem to agree on in terms of the politics and the business community and the other stakeholders, it is very much something like this. I think that during the campaign, Obama did embrace a Medicare for All option, a public option, if you will, and I had occasion to go back and look at some of that fairly recently. And his boilerplate on his campaign website did say that he was more vocal about having a public option. But somehow that was really never in the cards and became a bargaining chip all along the way for various groups.
And Trudy, I'm going to have to jump in because now the president is walking to the podium. Thank you for joining us. We go live to the White House. Vice President Biden, standing alongside the president. They look like twins, dark blue suits, white shirts, blue ties. Well, they dress like twins anyway.
There you go. Thank you all.
Both smiling from ear to ear, Obama applauding back.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. President, I think we got a happy room here. it seems ridiculous to say thank you all for being here. Ladies and gentlemen, to state the obvious, this is a historic day. In our business, we use that phrase a lot. But I can't think of a day in the 37 years that I've been a United States senator in the short time I've been vice president that it is more appropriately stated. This is a historic day. And history is not merely what is printed in textbooks. It doesn't begin or end with the stroke of a pen. History is made. History is made when men and women decide that there is a greater risk in accepting a situation that we cannot bear than in stealing our spine and embracing the promise of change. That's when history's made. History is made when you all assembled here today, members of Congress, take charge to change the lives of tens of millions of Americans through the efforts of those of us lucky enough to serve here in this town. That's exactly what you've done. You've made history. History is made when a leader steps up, stays true to his values, and charts a fundamentally different course for the country. History is made when a leader's passion is matched with principle to set a new course. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, you are that leader. Mr. President, your fierce advocacy, the clarity of purpose that you showed, your perseverance, these are, in fact, it is not hyperbole to say, these are the reasons why we're assembled in this room together today. But for those attributes, we would not be here. Many, many men and women are going to feel the pride that I feel in watching you shortly, watching you sign this bill, knowing that their work has helped make this day possible. But, Mr. President, you're the guy that made it happen. And so, Mr. President, all of us, press and elected officials, assembled in this town over the years, we've seen some incredible things happen. But you know, Mr. President, you've done what generations of not just ordinary, but great men and women have attempted to do. Republicans as well as Democrats. They've tried before. Everybody knows the story, starting with Teddy Roosevelt. They've tried. They were real bold leaders. But, Mr. President, they fell short. You have turned, Mr. President, the right of every American to have access into decent health care into reality for the first time in American history. Mr. President, I've gotten to know you well enough, you want me to stop because I'm embarrassing you. But I'm not going to stop for another minute, Mr. President, because you delivered on a promise you made to all Americans when we moved into this building. Mr. President, you are, to repeat myself, literally about to make history. Our children and our grandchildren, they're going to grow up knowing that a man named Barack Obama put the final girder in the framework for a social network in this country to provide the single most important element of what people need, and that is access to good health.
And that every American from this day forward will be treated with simple fairness and basic justice. Look, the classic poet Virgil once said that the greatest wealth is health. The greatest wealth is health. Well, today, America becomes a whole lot wealthier because tens of millions of Americans will be a whole lot healthier from this moment on. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Everybody, please have a seat. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Please, have a seat. Thank you, Joe.
Good to be with you, Mr. President.
Today, after almost a century of trying, today, after over a year of debate, today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America. Today. It is fitting that Congress passed this historic legislation this week. For as we mark the turning of spring, we also mark a new season in America. In a few moments, when I sign this bill, all of the overheated rhetoric over reform will finally confront the reality of reform. And while the Senate still has the last round of improvements to make on this historic legislation, and these are improvements I'm confident they will make swiftly, the bill I'm signing will set in motion reforms that generations of Americans have fought for and marched for and hungered to see. It'll take 4 years to implement fully many of these reforms because we need to implement them responsibly. We need to get this right. But a host of desperately needed reforms will take effect right away. This year, we'll start offering tax credits to about 4 million small businessmen and women to help them cover the cost of insurance for their employees. That happens this year. This year, tens of thousands of uninsured Americans with pre-existing conditions, the parents of children who have a pre-existing condition, will finally be able to purchase the coverage they need. That happens this year. This year, This year, insurance companies will no longer be able to drop people's coverage when they get sick. Yeah. They won't be able to place lifetime limits or restrictive annual limits on the amount of care they can receive. This year, all new insurance plans will be required to offer free preventive care. And this year, young adults will be able to stay on their parents' policies until they are 26 years old. That happens this year. And this year, seniors who fall in the coverage gap known as the donut hole will start getting some help. They'll receive $250 to help pay for prescriptions, and that will, over time, fill in the donut hole. And I want seniors to know, despite what some have said, these reforms will not cut your guaranteed benefits. In fact, under this law, Americans on Medicare will receive free preventive care without copayments or deductibles. That begins this year. Once this reform is implemented, health insurance exchanges will be created, a competitive marketplace where uninsured people and small businesses will finally be able to purchase affordable quality insurance. They will be able to be part of a big pool and get the same good deal that members of Congress get. That's what's going to happen under this reform. And when this exchange is up and running, millions of people will get tax breaks to help them afford coverage, which represents the largest middle-class tax cut for health care in history. That's what this reform's about. This legislation will also lower costs for families and for businesses and for the federal government, reducing our deficit by over $1 trillion in the next two decades. It is paid for, it is fiscally responsible, and it will help lift a decades-long drag on our economy. That's part of what all of you together worked on and made happen. That our generation is able to succeed in passing this reform is a testament to the persistence and the character of the American people who championed this cause, who mobilized, who organized, who believed that people who love this country can change it. It's also a testament to the historic leadership and uncommon courage of the men and women of the United States Congress who've taken their lumps during this difficult debate. You know, there are few tougher jobs in politics or government than leading one of our legislative chambers. In each chamber, there are men and women who come from different places and face different pressures, who reach different conclusions about the same things and feel deeply concerned about different things. By necessity, leaders have to speak to those different concerns. It isn't always tidy. It is almost never easy. But perhaps the greatest and most difficult challenge is to cobble together out of these differences the sense of common interest and common purpose that's required to advance the dreams of all people, especially in a country as large and diverse as ours. And we are blessed by leaders in each chamber who not only do their jobs very well, but who never lost sight of that larger mission. They didn't play for the short term. They didn't play to the polls or to politics. One of the best speakers the House of Representatives have ever had, Speaker Nancy Pelosi. one of the best majority leaders the Senate has ever had, Mr. Harry Reid. To all of the terrific committee chairs, all the members of Congress who did what was difficult, but did what was right, and passed health care reform, not just this generation of Americans will thank you, but the next generation of Americans will thank you. And of course, this victory was also made possible by the painstaking work of members of this administration, including our outstanding Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. And one of the unsung heroes of this effort, an extraordinary woman who led the reform effort from the White House, Nancy Ann DePaul. Yeah. Today, I'm signing this reform bill into law on behalf of my mother, who argued with insurance companies even as she battled cancer in her final days. I'm signing it for Ryan Smith, who's here today. He runs a small business with 5 employees. He's trying to do the right thing, paying half the cost of coverage for his workers. This bill will help him afford that coverage. I'm signing it for 11-year-old Marcellus Owens, who's also here. Marcellus, Marcellus lost his mom to an illness, and she didn't have insurance and couldn't afford the care that she needed. So in her memory, he has told her story across America so that no other children have to go through what his family's experienced. I'm signing it for Natoma Canfield. Natoma had to give up her health coverage after her rates were jacked up by more than 40%. She was terrified that an illness would mean she'd lose the house that her parents built, so she gave up her insurance. Now she's lying in a hospital bed, as we speak, faced with just such an illness, praying that she can somehow afford to get well without insurance. Natoma's family is here today because Natoma can't be, and her sister Connie's here. Connie, stand up. I'm signing this bill for all the leaders who took up this cause through the generations. From Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Roosevelt. From Harry Truman to Lyndon Johnson. From Bill and Hillary Clinton to one of the deans who's been fighting this so long, John Dingell. To Senator Ted Kennedy. And it's fitting that Ted's widow, Vicki, is here. It's fitting that Teddy's widow, Vicki, is here, and his niece, Caroline, his son, Patrick, whose vote helped make this reform a reality. Yeah. I remember seeing Ted walk through that door in a summit in this room a year ago, one of his last public appearances. And it was hard for him to make it. But he was confident that we would do the right thing. Our presence here today is remarkable and improbable. With all the punditry, all of the lobbying, all of the game playing that passes for governing in Washington, it's been easy at times to doubt our ability to do such a big thing, such a complicated thing, to wonder if there are limits to what we as a people can still achieve. It's easy to succumb to the sense of cynicism about what's possible in this country. But today we are affirming that essential truth, a truth every generation is called to rediscover for itself, that we are not a nation that scales back its aspirations. We are not a nation that falls prey to doubt or mistrust. We don't fall prey to fear. We are not a nation that does what's easy. That's not who we are. That's not how we got here. We are a nation that faces its challenges and accepts its responsibilities. We are a nation that does what is hard, what is necessary, what is right. Here in this country, we shape our own destiny. That is what we do. That is who we are. That is what makes us the United States of America. And we have now just enshrined, as soon as I sign this bill, the core principle that everybody should have some basic security when it comes to their health care. And it is an extraordinary achievement that has happened because of all of you and all the advocates all across the country. So thank you. Thank you. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
And with that, the President of the United States concludes his remarks, a room full of Democrats applauding and cheering. President Obama and Vice President Biden still standing at the podium, applauding back at the room.
I would now like to call up to stage some of the members of Congress who helped make this day possible and some of the Americans who will benefit from these reforms. And we're going to sign this bill.
And a few people are coming onto the stage now. A number of Americans, not in government, I presume, who are uninsured or perhaps have been locked out by the insurance companies for pre-existing conditions. Perhaps some of them have even had their insurance rescinded. Yes. Gathering around the president with Pelosi and Reid.
This is going to take a little while.
The president picking up the pen with his left hand. He is a lefty. About to sign the bill into law.
So it's going to take a really long time.
He's going to sign it numerous times. He signed it 3 or 4 times already. He's signing it with a number of different pens. And I'm not sure exactly how this works, whether he signs one letter of his name with one pen and another letter of his name with another pen. That looks to me like what he's doing, as he is not taking the time or making enough strokes to write Barack H. Obama. But he is using many pens. This is part of the ceremony, and I guess they'll be distributed to people who helped in the process, and who knows, wind up on eBay someday, perhaps. But this is how a ceremonial bill signing works. Remember, this is the Senate version of the bill agreed to by the House. A number of changes to the bill, which have been voted on by the House, are still awaiting passage by the Senate in the so-called reconciliation bill, and I imagine the president may get some criticism today for being premature in this celebration, but the law is that any primary bill must be signed first before a reconciliation bill to change it can be enacted. Senate Democratic leaders say passage will not be a problem, but Republicans will try to add amendments to force tension between the House and the Senate, and additional negotiations and votes So I don't know if there'll be another celebration in a few days, but this one is coming to a close. President now shaking the hands of the ordinary Americans on stage, representing people who would not have been covered were something like this not enacted, perhaps are not covered today, and people who are in similar circumstances to them in the future would be covered. The president hugging members of his staff, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. And whether you're for this or against this is something that has been in the political pipeline in one form or another for 100 years, as the president said, and something that Democrats and even some Republicans, Richard Nixon did have a version of universal health care that he had signed on to. Of course, times have changed very much in the United States since the Nixon administration. And so this is something that many, many people did not know if they would ever see in their lifetimes. And today they did. There it is. President Obama has signed the health care bill. And that's it for today's program. Lisa Allison, Jody Avergon, Paige Cowett, and Alan Smith produced this program. We had intern help today from Amanda Magnus and Matthew Gurry, and our senior producer is Megan Ryan. Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. I'm Brian Lehrer.